I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, a previously unreleased conversation with writer M.K. Anderson, who a few months back wrote a rather interesting piece for Protean Magazine entitled On Eugenics, Richard Dawkins Offers Nothing But Sophistry. Now, a little bit of background, this particular piece came about after Richard Dawkins, the celebrity evolutionary biologist, wrote on Twitter, "It's one thing to deplore eugenics on ideological, political, and moral grounds. It's quite another to conclude that it wouldn't work in practice." Of course it would. It works for cows, horses, pigs, dogs, and roses. Why on earth wouldn't it work for humans? Facts ignore ideology. M.K. Anderson, however, says Dawkins is wrong. That Dawkins is getting the facts incorrect about eugenics, its scientific validity, and its political implications. So, with that background in mind, let's get right into the conversation with M.K. Anderson, author of On Eugenics, Richard Dawkins Offers Nothing But Sophistry, at Protean Magazine. Welcome to Parallax Views. M.K. Anderson, writer of the new article on Protean Magazine's website, On Eugenics, Richard Dawkins Offers Nothing But Sophistry. We'll be talking about that. But first, maybe you could introduce yourself to my audience, M.K. And also, how are you doing today, I should ask?
Oh, I'm just fine. Thank you. How are you?
Good.
I'm a writer. I started my career after I got my first degree, doing direct care for developmentally disabled people. That first degree was in political science, so it's sort of a philosophy, politics background. And then I moved into sort of financial analysis after my second degree, which was in accounting. I did some regulating of Medicare, Medicaid, and the oil and gas industry. So that's kind of my background.
And what led you to write, well, not just this article, but you have written a few articles on issues related to mental health policy. You wrote an article on moral injury for the Institute for Christian Socialism. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the importance of healthcare to a lot of your writing.
Sure. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, which, definitely makes this a personal issue for me. And also having done direct care for people who are developmentally disabled, often dual diagnosis, meaning they have more than one thing going on, geriatric or seriously mentally ill, that makes this very personal to me. It's what radicalized me. It's what made me into a communist. And so I think it's very important that, as a communist, we talk about the material realities of how capitalism oppresses us, and that's often very specific to how we're marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, before we jump into the meat and bones, or meat and potatoes of the article you wrote on Richard Dawkins, I guess I should give a little background. Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist and public intellectual of the new atheist movement, recently tweeted, "It's one thing to deplore eugenics on ideological, political, moral grounds. It's quite another to conclude that it wouldn't work in practice. Of course it would. It works for cows, horses, pigs, dogs, and roses. Why on earth wouldn't it work for humans? Facts ignore ideology." And of course, this caused a huge uproar from people like me and yourself who just found this despicable. And of course, there's the other side saying, yeah, "Oh, you social justice warriors trying to suppress Dawkins." It just makes my head spin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that he misdefines the term and tries to claim this, you know, sort of irrationality is his own, and we're just very emotional and we don't understand what he's talking about, and that's why we're pissed off. And instead, it's just, you know, it's annoying when people are wrong and arrogant about it.
I guess the place we should start with this is maybe defining terms a bit. It seems like, sure, in some ways, Dawkins may have a different definition of eugenics,
yeah,
than other people. Maybe you could get into a basic definition and history of eugenics as a movement.
Sure. So Dawkins, you know, is especially galling because Dawkins is an evolutionary psychologist, even though he's sort of tried to take that authority and you know, talk about atheism and stuff. His background is evolutionary psychology.
Is he evolutionary biology?
You're right. I apologize. It's evolutionary biology.
I wasn't trying to undermine you. I just wanted to make sure we were accurate, yeah, so people can't throw it back at us.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. My bad. He's an evolutionary biologist, so he, you know, is supposed to know exactly what he's talking about in terms of like, in terms of like what evolution is. He has basically in his tweets treated it as exactly the same as selective breeding, as what is that term? It's artificial selection. He's used it interchangeably with artificial selection, and he's basically saying, well, of course, if you breed for milk production, you'll end up with more milk production. But the thing is, you know, nobody ever, you know, slaughtered 6 million people for milk production, for human milk production. That's ridiculous. Eugenics has never been concerned with objective traits in human beings. It's never been about that. It's about attaching a moral and political value to traits that are sometimes not, you know, like, can you find me the goodness gene? Can you find me the smartness gene? There just aren't any. These are all sort of abstract terms.
Well, it's like when you look at certain disorders, like, say, I don't know, ADHD or maybe Asperger's syndrome, mm-hmm, the sort of negative value we place on these things, it's highly subjective to some degree or another.
Yeah, and it's culture bound. Like, you know, I don't sleep well at night. I sleep much better during the day, and you know, that's inconvenient now, but you know, back in hunter-gatherer times, maybe that would have been valuable. It's incredibly situationally dependent. And I think I used in the article an example. The Nazis actually went after people with schizophrenia, hoping to get rid of schizophrenia. They wiped out between 70 and 100% of the schizophrenic population. And then the rates of that actually went up because it's not just genetic factors. Probably a lot of people are carriers of that particular disorder, and the environment, the amount of stress, like a war, will make people express that trait when it otherwise wouldn't be expressed. So why? It was just a lot of slaughter for nothing, for absolutely nothing, except for the enrichment of like a few people.
I want to dive into that a little bit more, but first I want to add, a lot of people, when they think of eugenics, they immediately just think of Nazi Germany. But if we look at the work of, say, a historian like Edwin Black, author of IBM and the Holocaust, he wrote a book a while back called The War Against the Weak, and he showed how a lot of these ideas actually originate in America. And I'm not sure that they ever really left us.
No, they did not. Absolutely not. Eugenics, I wrote another article in Protean Magazine about, sound a little bit nerdy, the intermediate care facility exclusion for Medicare funding, which let me look that up. It's not ICFMR. It's another term. It's an exclusion for long-term care facilities for mental illness. Those are excluded from funding from Medicare and Medicaid as part of a process which mentally ill people and their advocates advocated for, because people were put in prisons, basically, without recourse, without the ability to appeal that. And it was sort of this forced segregation. And then those facilities were not funded. So we had places like Willowbrook in the 70s, which had concentration camp-like conditions. And I am not exaggerating that at all. We had children in pitch dark, naked, and covered in their own feces with one minder to 100 children. And that was in the 70s. That's why this went away. Or why people fought to get rid of it. And sometimes you hear people talk about this wonderful before time when people used to be taken care of. Absolutely not. That did not happen. Never did. It was always violence.
I was going to mention, too, we can also see this in the history of forced sterilization in this country. From African Americans to Native Americans, there's a long history of this that is very disturbing, very racist, absolutely, very ableist, and even classist.
Absolutely. And it is not to exclude anybody of other races. I just simply have slightly more expertise on the mental health stuff. We have Buck v. Bell. It is still on the books legal to sterilize mentally ill and mentally people with intellectual disabilities via a court order if it's quote unquote for their own good. That is absolutely legal. That is American law, and we have not changed that.
Maybe we could delve a little bit deeper into the mental health side of this before getting back to the subject of Dawkins, because I think a lot of people would counter or maybe just think in their head, oh, it's not like it used to be, like it was, you know, in, say, Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Things aren't that bad anymore. We had all kinds of reforms. And I'm sure there's been improvements, but there's still issues, problems.
Yes, there absolutely are. Yeah. I would say the main thing, I'd say things are better than they were in terms of like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest forced institutionalization. However, there are still forced institutionalizations. 72-hour holds are often very violent and often, if you're a danger to yourself or other, they can section you often for 72 hours, but those can be very violent. And also, they don't offer a lot of treatment during that time period. It's mostly to warehouse you because to make sure that time passes. And if you don't have insurance and if you don't have money, if you need additional care, too bad. It's not care in America is mostly built around a false idea that mentally ill people are significantly more violent than the general population. Now, there is a very tiny subpopulation that is the overlap of serious substance abuse and serious mental illness, where there is a moderate to high increase in violence. But absent that overlap, that very specific overlap, which is 1 or 2% of the general population at most, something like 5% of the population at any given time has a mental health problem, and something like 20% of people in their lifetime will have a mental health problem. But half the people in our prisons are mentally ill, and not all of them are there for violence. A lot of them are simply because they're disabled, they're poor, and they can't afford defense the way that other people do. It ends up being more economic than anything else than having to do with their behavior. It's more to do with that maybe they use pot to treat anxiety. And so we've got a lot of people who absolutely do not deserve to be in prison because they are no danger to anyone being subjected to that horribly violent system.
If I could add to that briefly, I would also say that I still think there's a rather dehumanizing popular mentality when it comes to dealing with the topic of people that have some type of mental health issue. I think of... Are you familiar with Simon Baron Cohen? Does that name ring a bell?
Sasha Baron Cohen?
No. This is actually, this is his cousin. But he's one of the main...
Really?
Yeah, he's one of the main researchers into autism and borderline personality, sort of neurological disorders, as well as personality disorders. But he's done stuff like, you know, made blanket statements about people with these disorders. He's done books where he'll diagnose dead celebrities, and it all just seems very just dehumanizing to me. And also he's a really sort of pop science author that's popularly read. Yeah. And the thing that really stands out to me is he sort of takes away autonomy from the people suffering from mental health issues in a lot of ways. And I see a lot of that actually, not just with him, but others as well.
Yeah. So obviously I'm not familiar with him, but I am familiar with the attitude. And yeah, there's definitely a very like speaking about us like we're not just animals, but dangerous animals. And that's, you know, I feel a lot of pressure, personally, to have to be incredibly rational. I have to be able to put up this thing where I have to be, you know, I went into these very analytical fields. I went into accounting. I did political science and while it may not always seem so online, I was like with, you know, lawyers with political science degrees type thing. Like that. I went through sort of a rigorous philosophical study where I studied rhetoric. I studied ancient and medieval political thought. I read Aristotle. Like I know all these things that, you know, hyper-rationalist people like Dawkins claim as their heritage, you know, sort of their cultural heritage, you know, the West. And they suck at it. it's mildly infuriating.
We'll get into that. I guess what I was trying to get at was, I think sometimes if someone with a mental health issue says, I am being abused, or I am being mistreated, or
yes,
you're not considering my own autonomy because I have a mental health issue, I think that they're dismissed a lot of times. And I think that's a really huge issue.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been, I worked at a small employer, about 15 people, and that meant that they were less than 15. That meant that when they offered insurance, they were Obamacare exempt. So when I said, hey, this doesn't offer any mental health coverage, they replied, you're fired.
Right.
So I've experienced that. People with mental illness, you know, there's a material impact to that. Like, people with mental illness are more likely to be assaulted or raped. They're much more likely to be the targets of violence than to commit any violence. And it's because I think there's a misunderstanding about the root cause of violence. People are violent to gain something they want or to stop something they don't want. It's to control behavior. It's not some irrational, unknowable thing. And they're also violent. They're more likely to use violence when they can get away with it. And if they have a target that will not be believed, those people are sitting ducks. We're sitting ducks, and people aren't going to believe us. And that's really unfortunate.
And we also see it reflected in the popular media. It's almost like people with mental health issues are reduced to stereotypes. Oh, you suffer from depression. You must be like Edgar Allan Poe or like a Kurt Cobain, or you have borderline personality. Isn't that the thing in Fatal Attraction? And it's like, or with Asperger's syndrome, I always hear people say, oh, they're like Spock from Star Trek. Like, it's so just, it just reduces people to a caricature.
Yeah, it absolutely does that. Absolutely. People don't know how to relate to it. They're fearful of it, or it's a joke. I mean, I can't, I feel like if I had cancer or something like that, I wouldn't suddenly be subhuman. I know that people, I do know that generally, people have difficulty sitting with suffering. I think that's sort of a universal human thing. So I don't want to say that people who have other illnesses don't get abandoned and don't get mistreated, because that's absolutely not true. I mean, abuses happen all the time to ill people simply because they are vulnerable. But I feel like in those cases, in cases like cancer or lupus or being hit by a car or something, people at least intellectually know that those aren't okay. But if you're mentally ill, sometimes there's like open conversations about whether that person is worth having in your life, because they're a lot of work. And it's like, well, everybody is eventually a lot of work. We all, if we are fortunate, become very elderly and require a lot of help. We're all dependent on one another. But the conversation becomes about, well, who is it okay for us to abandon? And mentally ill people absolutely make that list.
Getting back to the Dawkins article that you wrote, I think this all ties together. And it also ties into what we're seeing now with this sort of far-right, alt-right in America, the Richard Spencers of the world. In a way, Dawkins almost acts as the mainstream version of that when it comes to an issue like eugenics. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I talked about this a little bit. I think the way I put it in the article is that because of how he's framed it, because he's treated this as non-ideological, because he's framed his misframing of eugenics as
artificial selecting.
Artificial selection and apolitical, which is not correct. It's always been a political movement to change the human race, to have these immaterial goals like goodness or the betterment of mankind, whatever the hell that means. And trying to treat those things as just objective. Like, of course, everybody wants X or Y or Z. Of course, these specific values are correct. And we can, of course, breed people for those values, which is ridiculous. And just, yeah, just completely ridiculous. And because he tried to say, and that's what natural selection is, or artificial selection is. And then he's placed that as sort of ideologically neutral and said that that it becomes a moral argument. The problem with that is that it's like, well, we can all disagree on moral arguments. We can say, well, if eugenics works, if it works to get its stated goals, its stated political goals of the betterment of mankind, it becomes a matter of just personal disagreement over whether we agree with those goals and the means and whether it's worth it. And especially as we previously discussed, in a society where the suffering of mentally ill people is perfectly acceptable, honestly, it sort of naturally follows that that he can sort of wash his hands of what these other people are doing, but he's primed them to accept this ridiculous argument. If you follow his argument to its ends with all of the things we're taught to believe about mentally ill people, a very large portion of the people who follow him will come to what they think is the rational conclusion that eugenics is an ethical and effective way to improve the world. And that is more than just irresponsible, more than unethical for him to do. It is, even by his own terms, even by these very rational terms, he's been incredibly sloppy and irrational about it.
And again, if we could, let's iron out. What's interesting about your article is that you're not even going for the, well, this is just heinous that he would even suggest this. I mean, you are saying that, but you actually get into detail of, well, no, it actually, eugenics doesn't actually work. Correct. Version of eugenics, artificial selection, doesn't work the way he thinks it does. Maybe we could dive a little bit deeper into that. And this whole idea of desirable versus undesirable traits. I don't know if you can breed that.
So are we talking about like turkeys? Like, I think I mentioned turkeys an example. Like, yes, farmed turkeys cannot mate. We have to help them out if we want more turkeys. The ancestor to corn, which is, you know, if you've seen like those little like grass when it gets too long and it's waving in the wind and it's got the little seeds at the end, that's what corn used to look like. That's what people used to sort of harvest and try and get just a little bit of nutrition from. It's a grass and it's like little grass seeds. But the way we've bred it, we need to fertilize corn if we want more corn. When we selected for cows to increase the production of milk, and this didn't make it in the article, producing more milk, the cows that produce more milk had fertility problems, and you need to make more baby cows for cows to begin producing milk in the first place. So if they have fertility problems, they don't produce any milk. So artificial selection is not a straightforward process, even if we have traits that we're aiming for. It takes a lot of work. It's very messy, and it produces undesirable traits along with desirable ones. So if we did decide that what eugenics meant was artificial selection, he would be wrong. It doesn't work, and it doesn't produce the results it claims to. And then on top of that, we have to produce all this human suffering for something that just doesn't freaking work.
What do you think about the sort of separation he makes between morals and, oh, it works? I mean, we've already defined why eugenics doesn't work, but what do you think of that separation he plays out? I'm not saying that it's – I don't want to, like, say he's being deceptive, although I may actually think that he is being deceptive. But
– I mean, he's – I feel frustrated because he's a public intellectual and he's perfectly capable of reading a book, but – I guess we could talk a little bit about moral philosophy. Moral philosophy is very concerned with whether the actions we are taking are effective. Most ethics, you know, talk about intention versus impact. And whether something works is for example, utilitarian ethics. There's just plain utilitarian ethics, and then there's rules utilitarians, but let's focus on just utilitarian ethics. Utilitarian ethics says if it works and it produces a good outcome, the best possible outcome, that is the ethical thing to do. So this distinction he's making, I mean, he would say, oh, that's terrible, but and rules utilitarianism did eventually replace utilitarianism just because there need to be like, okay, in addition to we want to produce the best possible outcome, maybe let's not murder anybody. That'd be good. But I almost want to defend the utilitarians and say, no, actually, this you have to look at in order to be a good utilitarian, you have to care about what works. In order to be a good ethical person, you have to care about reality. So it is an artificial distinction. I think it is even, I think in any moral system, there's always a concern with whether the action you're taking is effective for the ends you claim to want. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And of course, eugenics, as you point out, pursues the improvement of humanity by defining what is good and bad in these highly subjective, and as you said, culturally bound terms. So it's this kind of behavior is bad, so we have to get rid of these people. That's sort of where it ends up leading.
Yes, and it prescribes a very specific set of steps, and I think if we're going to discuss it, we have to discuss those steps and whether they actually do work. And the you know, I feel like it's a gestalt. It's a thing that is irreducible. That you have to assess all parts of it and just sort of separating it out, breaking it down. You know, there's a criticism of empiricism is that it breaks things down into discrete categories where sometimes none exist. And that creates a fallacy, like just because this is the process you need to follow, because that is what you're doing, that you are a scientist, doesn't mean that that's the process we ought to follow in all things. It's not always appropriate. It's not always rational. And sometimes the distinction between wolves and dogs who can interbreed with each other and all that sort of thing, it's a little bit, we need those distinctions a little bit more than nature does. We're just trying to describe nature with them. We are not the perfect mirrors of nature when we're following empiricism. We are incredibly imperfect in how we describe it.
It's always interesting to me when the right talks about man within the state of nature, because I don't think we live within a state of nature. I think we have a thing called civilization, but what do I know?
Man in his natural state does this and that. Well, you know, if you want to go live in a state of nature, have at, buddy. Like, let's see if you can hack it. But we have very much shaped our own environment and we've made choices about it. And we don't want to go into the natural is good fallacy. That's not a good one. That's not a good line of thought to follow. It doesn't follow. So.
Well, not only that, it also, there's a whole idea I've seen on the right wing, and even amongst people adjacent to Richard Dawkins, the one that comes to mind is this libertarian sort of skeptic guy by the name of Michael Shermer, who has talked about tooth and claw and the state of nature and all this stuff. And I mean, he does push back against it in his book that he wrote dealing with it. But the thing is, this idea of like man in his original state was tooth and claw and how we live now is unnatural. I just don't understand that conceptually, because to me, cooperation is pretty natural. It's how we got to the point we're at now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we are a social animal. How we got to where we are is because we're a social animal. I've read studies that the size of our brains as primates predicts how many people we can sort of keep track of and empathize with and be in community with, and our success, you know, quote unquote success, we're about to freaking destroy the planet, is due to the fact that we are able to follow these complex hierarchies of, you know, form complex hierarchies, able to follow, okay, my husband loves his mother-in-law, but he's got a weird relationship with his dad, and then, you know, dad's girlfriend, you know, that sort of thing. Our ability to follow that complex web means that we know what resources we have socially, that we can cooperate, that we can build things, and we can delegate tasks, because, you know, other primates, they are personally responsible for most of their own survival, even if, as they cooperate, and our ability to delegate and communicate well enough to delegate, it's huge. So yeah, this is us in nature. And, to decide that it's sort of a self-glorification of really successful men as having got there on it their own, and
when we know that's not really the case. I mean, this whole idea of meritocracy just blows my mind that people still buy into this idea of meritocracy, because I see nepotism in our society, nepotism, sexism, racism, on a daily basis.
Yep. Yeah, and those are anti-competitive. You know, that those benefit specific people. They benefit the powerful at the expense of the less powerful. And like the one thing I really want to drill home to anybody who's any kind of skeptical is eventually we're all vulnerable. Every single one of us. Eventually we all get old if we are lucky. And your wealth does not protect you from that. Sometimes, like toward the ends of their lives, you hear about people with immense wealth being incredibly abused because they're no longer able to advocate for themselves, and there are people who come in and take advantage of them. And, you know, as much of a monster as Donald Trump is, he's not going to be immune from that if he lives.
Could I add something to that?
And I would hope, yeah. Sure.
Well, what I'd like to add to that, I recently graduated from university, and I noticed I left university for a few years, and then I came back to it, right? And I noticed that there's a lot more young men now that are buying into this, you know, social Darwinism, eugenics, might makes right. And the arguments I've had with these young men, I can't even understand and comprehend their way of thinking, because they'll say might makes right, and then I'll just respond with something like, well, you believe might makes right until an anti-fascist activist punches you in the face. Or, you know, when you get old, you're not going to believe in might makes right. You're going to say, I want someone to take care of me. It just blows my mind when they sort of stare back at me vacantly and say that they'd never thought of that before. It's a real sad state of affairs when we have so many young people buying into this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fascism in a lot of ways, and I think this is a fascist tendency that you're describing, is a death cult. It's a cult where we're all trained to be heroes. We're all trained to be strong. Those of us who can't manage that particularly brutal standard are disposed of very early on. But there's no grace for there's no room in a society full of heroes for a hero who failed by surviving. If you survived a war and you come back, you know, or any difficult thing that you were told to go out and do by the most strong man there is, if you survive this life, you come back and there's no help for you. There's no compassion for you. There's no softness for you. And so, as much as I'm like, fascists do a lot of active harm. People who are brainwashed into that sort of cult of masculinity do a lot of harm. One of my very good friends right now is a former soldier, and I know that's kind of taboo when some left soldiers, oh, a troop, you know, stuff like that. But he's very penitent. He does a lot of de-radicalization work, in my opinion, of former and to be troops. As part of what he feels is sort of penitence, and does a lot of service for those people, because there's no place for used up soldiers. There's no place for used up fascists, and I think the young men need to hear that. There's no soft place for you.
I would also add, you know, when I talk to these young men that are radicalized, I almost like feel like shaking them and telling them, you know, the world you're describing is something we're already living in a lot of ways. If you are a troop that comes back from the war and you have PTSD, you will be discarded. If you're getting older, you can be easily thrown in a nursing home. In many ways, what these young men describe as their ideal world, their might makes right world, we're already living in it. And that's the scary part to me. And the other thing I would add to that is I think people like Richard Dawkins are sort of a gateway drug to further radicalization. And when they say something like, oh, Charles Murray is being suppressed and it's so horrible what's done to him and he's been treated so badly, I always think to myself, Charles Murray is working at the Cato Institute. He just had a new book come out called Human Diversity. He doesn't sound like he's doing that bad. There are people in our communities that are not doing bad, that are doing bad. Charles Murray isn't living out in a cardboard box. I think he's doing pretty well.
No. Yeah, there's a strange sort of fragility there that might just be, you know, by their own perception, a kind of injustice. But there's a strange sort of fragility that's disconnected from the material world, where it's like, what else could you possibly want? Why aren't you happy? I don't know. I wish those young men could, I mean, deep down, I feel like they would be happier if it's like, don't you want a life where if you fail, if you fuck up, if you're ever wrong, if you're ever weak, if you're ever less than intellectually perfect, you are still worthwhile. Don't you want that for yourself? Don't you want that for yourself?
I was just going to add, and where you don't have to respond to everything with the only acceptable male emotion of anger, apparently.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, it's, or where if, I mean, not to brag on myself, this is just what I've been told that I'm intimidating by dudes because I know my stuff and I'm pretty rigorous when I want to be. And it's like, don't you want to come hang out? Like, instead of like, you know, have to be the strongest person, have to fight me for supremacy, like wrestle me because you're threatened or whatever. It's not, I'm not like bragging. It's just sort of a fact of my life that sometimes, like, I like being friends with dudes. I like some of my best friends are dudes. And I appreciate, I love my male friends. I love my man friends very much. And sort of, it's just a shame when this weird obsession with strength makes people paradoxically very soft and very unable to handle that maybe somebody else might be better at this thing, or in this specific circumstance might be better at something. And wouldn't it be great to go, like, my husband is a very compassionate man. He loves animals. He's a sweet, sweet, sweet man. And he is very bright and very funny. And the thing is, I can appreciate him for all of those things, not just he is so strong and manly, because sometimes it's not. And that's fine. Like, that's great.
Well, before we start wrapping up, the other thing I wanted to mention, and then we'll start to sort of bring this all back full circle, was you mentioned utilitarianism and ethics. And one thing that I've heard from people online, and also some of the men I've met on campus with these weirdly alt-right views, and like I said, it's a bizarre phenomenon to me. It's very sad. I've heard people say, well, eugenics isn't bad, but the way it was carried out was bad. And I've never understood that argument. And I've always said to them, the logical endpoint of your argument for eugenics, ultimately, it would be carried out violently. Because what you're saying is that certain people are a net drain. And for the greater good, you would get rid of them. And it just seems to shock them when I point that out, because it's like they haven't thought of that before.
Yeah, they don't think that out. I think a lot of eugenicist policy now is more focused on starving people than murdering them. Although I do think mass incarceration, the three tools of eugenics are segregation from the general population, which imprisonment, which actual segregation, like redlining, achieved, sterilization, and murder. Those are the three ones that there, possibly there are others, but those are the three I've identified, personally. And all of those require force. And one of the ways that we achieve that, functionally, I don't want to sound like I'm a conspiracy theorist, and some people in a room had a big strokey beard meeting and said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to murder all the disabled people. No, what they do is they've got a pot of money. It's only so big, and they decide how to allocate it. And at the end of the day, something in their head says, well, disabled people are just a little bit less human, so they get just a little bit less money than, you know, people who are productive and strong and you know, carrying this society. And so we end up with, like, social security, like, if you get both parts of it as a disabled person, might max out at $1,500, $1,700, which is not a living wage anywhere. And if you get just SSDI, which is the more limited one, the one that lets you have any assets at all, because if you get the full Social Security income, it's this horrible sadistic choice. You either get a slightly higher income, which is not enough, but you get to own no assets, nothing over $3,000, nothing, which means if there's an emergency, you are screwed. You won't be able to, like, have enough to have a deposit to move out. And then housing assistance can take years to get on. So if you are dependent on an abusive person, you're shit out of luck. Sorry. Or you can get the lesser amount of money and you can have savings, but it's like $500 a month. And if people, like, I don't know what people think is going to, how that's going to turn out. How is that not going to turn into people dying? And the answer is, well, it absolutely does. People end up in jail because they're trying to support themselves through sex work or selling drugs or stealing or whatever else. They end up living in exploitative conditions, or they end up living on the streets. And all of those predictably lead to violence and predictably lead to death. And us pretending otherwise is irrational. And the way we justify that is this is a state of nature, and no, it's not. We have made a choice about what we value, because we give a whole lot of corporate welfare. Is that natural? No, that's a choice we made, and we can make other choices.
One thing that I found interesting in this article, so we've talked about how Dawkins will talk about logic and reason, but sort of ignore the history. And that's not mm-hmm. rational. And you point out that Dawkins doesn't seem to care about that. And neither would his fans. And there's one line I wanted you to elaborate on, if you could.
Sure.
And it's in reference to Dawkins and his fans. They have logos without essos, logos without pathos, logos without facts, logos fed only by a self-flattering, twisted subjectivity. What do you mean by that? I'm just curious if you could elaborate a little bit more on that.
I'm sort of referring to rhetoric about how when we talk to one another, there's this logic, like there are three parts to making a convincing argument. An argument itself is not everything we do is an argument. An argument is like setting up a baseball game, a discussion is a debate. It's not what we're doing all the time. And there are three parts to it. There's logic, but there's also the authority to speak on the topic. You can't say that just because you have authority that the argument is correct, but you might not be the person with the experience to make that argument, and you might not have the empathy that gives you the correct information, because there's sort of you need to be able to empathize with your fellow human being. You are talking to a person. You're not just making this logical, structured argument and that's how you win. No, you're trying to convince people. You're speaking to a person. So they almost like fundamentally misunderstand rhetoric. And they also misunderstand, like, I think this twisted subjectivity is one that sort of glorifies themselves, that places themselves as both the both a person in this argument duking it out with other people, and also objective enough to referee the fight. And that's so self-serving, and it's so subjective. It's not actually objective. It's ultimately subjective to place yourself as this ultimate no world, while you're also trying. Like it's almost what is that called when you don't believe in an outside world? It's solipsism. It's also almost an ultimate solipsism where you're making an argument and it doesn't matter who you're talking to. Like, why talk at all?
Out of curiosity, I know you don't speculate in the article about this, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on it. Dawkins, as you point out in the article, he may have a moral issue with eugenics. That's his claim. But in saying it works, he clears the way for people who don't share, as you put it, that distaste morally that he has for eugenics. So then why is Dawkins... what is driving Dawkins on this? Like, why even come out and start talking about eugenics? What is actually going on there? I know we can't get inside his headspace, but...
Sure. So, generally, I like to focus on the function of what it does. And the function of it is sort of Foucauldian, like, here's how it impacts the system. But if I had to speculate... there are two possibilities. One, he's not brave enough to say what he really thinks. And I think that's the more simple explanation, but not necessarily the more correct one. What I think really motivates these people is that, especially people like Dawkins, is that getting in the back door, I'm not just a pugilist in this fight. I'm not just the person in this fight having this debate, duking it out with another person. I am also the ref. I think that's what he's getting out of this, is positioning himself, is that sort of ultimate self-glorification. I think it's very tempting. I think it's very seductive. I think that's what he offers, is you don't just, if you're like me, if you follow this, if you get if you follow what I want you to do, you get to be the strongest, you get to be the most rational, and you get to do that without ever being curious about other people. You get to do it without actually ever being good at rhetoric. He offers the simplest, most lazy caricature of what it is to be a rational, excellent human being, one that demands nothing of you, and then calls it the highest thing you can possibly be. And that is so tempting.
Are you familiar with the... There's this thing he has called the Dawkins Circle. Have you heard of that before?
I try not to follow him too hard.
That's fair.
What is the Dawkins Circle?
So you can get membership in the Dawkins Circle and have, you know, dinner with him once a year and other benefits if you pay him between $1,000 and $9,999 a year. I mean, it blows my mind. Maybe that's why people join, though. They're like, oh, if Dawkins, you know, if I join the Dawkins Circle, I'm sort of one of these, I'm the best person, I'm the smartest person, the highest IQ.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That, I was not aware he was actually selling something. I knew he was selling something, but I didn't know he was monetizing the thing he was selling. But yeah, no, that makes... that about sums it up, doesn't it, folks?
there's one more thing I want to add real quick. And maybe we can just briefly talk about it. When I look at people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Charles Murray, I tend to see people that lead very privileged lives. And I kind of wonder if maybe the reason, say, a Sam Harris is obsessed with IQ is because Sam Harris, as the son of the inventor of the TV show The Golden Girls, he was born with a silver spoon. And maybe this is like a way of justifying their position in the world and saying, I'm here because I'm just genetically superior.
Yeah, no, it's very hard to make your way in the world, which has a lot of suffering in it, and not believe that if you have a privilege, that it's not because you deserve that privilege, because the alternative is you're morally obligated to give that up for a better world, and to sit and be vulnerable with everybody else and rely on other people, and that's not very appealing. Yeah, I agree with you on that. Is it okay if we touch on one thing?
Yeah, there was one more thing I wanted to ask, but go ahead, yeah.
Sure. Actually, you go ahead and ask it, and then I'll sort of get on my little soapbox about ID politics as it relates to socialism, if that's okay.
Yeah, no,
would that be okay?
Well, this actually may relate in some form or another, but I'll give you your soapbox.
Sure.
I just want to ask you real quickly. you said that you're a communist. Now,
yes,
I consider myself a member of the left. I don't like say, oh, I'm this or that, but I consider myself on the left, and people always say to me,
sure,
ah, you believe that we can just get rid of all hierarchies, that they'll just cease to exist. And I personally think we can flatten hierarchies. And that's what I tell people when they ask that. And I also say, you know, in a communist society or a socialist society, if we try to create something like that, it doesn't mean that people won't have different outcomes. And I don't think any leftist has ever really implied that, oh, yeah, we're all just going to have the same exact outcome. I'm so tired of hearing this straw man argument, equality of outcome. It's completely inane.
Yes.
And yeah, I want to your take on that.
I'm sort of I try and avoid stating what my tendency is because honestly, I study history for advice on how to go forward. I don't necessarily want to relitigate the past, and I think that can be kind of a trap. I will work it with anybody doing the work as long as they are not abusive, as long as they are, you know, and who is a good person is so dependent on what you're locally doing and what your goals are that I feel like it's almost not worth getting into. But yeah, there's a lot of different ways to be communist. I kind of suspect that there's probably more than one way that we can achieve it. But yeah, there's living under communism isn't going to cure my PTSD. I'm still going to have difficulties. I'm going to have difficulties laboring, and that's because labor makes people's lives meaningful. It's not just something we do for money. My struggles with working, my struggles with being productive, that's going to affect my quality of life, even if I had all my other needs met. The need for meaning is still a little bit hampered by that. But like, don't we want to feed everybody? Like, come on.
That's what I mean. Like, you know, I want to live in a radically different society, and I will admit that to people. But this idea that I've never heard a leftist say in a radically different society there wouldn't be different outcomes. Like, there's still going to be parents who parent better than the other parent. There's still going to be differences. It's not like we're going to all be like a gelatinous glob like Jordan Peterson would have us believe. It's completely ridiculous. You know, I just want people to have health care and child care and be treated like human beings. That's all I really want at the end of the day. It just blows my mind that people have such weird ideas about the left because they've been fed BS by the right wing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think the problem is that the way we live in this country is, you know, the electronics I'm speaking to you on now, the electronics you used, these are mined from conflict minerals. There are conflict minerals in every piece of technology we have. We are very dependent on imperialism. And in order to no longer do that, we're going to have to live a very different lifestyle. And that means that the people who are profiting immensely off of that, they're very threatened. And they are defending their power, their way of life, their own superiority, their own ego, like just like Richard Dawkins is. And because they're willing to use immense violence, and because defense against that is going to look potentially violent, and that's unfortunate. I don't want that to be the case. I'm hoping for other means of resisting that. But we're talking about, you know, there are a not insignificant portion of our food, of our electronics, we rely on slave labor, and not figurative, actual slave labor. And we need to end that. We need to end that by any means necessary. And let's just hope that those means are nonviolent, that's what it takes. That, you know, that's my prayer.
And I know you said that you wanted to talk a little bit about this issue of ID politics. I'll give you the floor now to talk about that.
Sure. So there's a lot of talk within the left, among the left, about identity politics as, like, it's used as a pejorative, like the thing that's lobbed back and forth at people are class reductionist versus identity politics. And I worry that people who talk about class as the primary and only struggle, and that all other struggles are non-existent, let's say. I do believe in dialectical materialism. I do believe that history is the movement of the wealthy and then the underclass in reaction to that. And that's that struggle that goes back and forth. I want people to pay more attention because people will dismiss what I'm talking about as pure identity politics, as, you know, eugenics, talking about the struggles of quote unquote crazy people or people who are not white and all that. That's just identity politics. It's a distraction from class, which is the only conflict, which is the only war. And what I want to say is I want people to get more interested in how capitalism fractures the proletariat, how it takes each of our material conditions, our background, what we're able to, whether, you know, how it sets, you need to be able to work 40 hours a week. And if you're not, then you get to starve. Or you look a particular way, therefore you get to live in these neighborhoods. The solution isn't just to realize this is a way we're divided. It's also to realize this is a way we're set against each other, that there is real trauma there, there's real hurt there. It's not just arbitrary. These are the material conditions we live in, and we must fight those material conditions. We can't just say unite by magic and make those material conditions go away. And that's sort of my rebuttal to anybody who's listening to this and says, this is just, you know, an oversensitive, crazy woman who wants us to focus on identity politics and stop paying attention to class warfare. And I'm like, no, these are the battles within the war that we need to pay attention to.
It's interesting because I've spoken to people on the left on both sides of that issue, and I lean much more towards intersectionality itself is not really a bad thing. I think sometimes there are centrist Democrats that may misuse the idea of intersectionality.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think – even if we had a radically different society in terms of class, I don't know that that would get rid of racism overnight.
No, it wouldn't. No, yeah, it wouldn't. And honestly, I kind of wonder if we don't, within our movements, figure out a way to be kind to one another. I don't mean in a legalistic way. I don't mean you have to do all of these things perfect. I mean, we must find a way to be interpersonally kind to one another. We must find a way to be interpersonally ethical to one another and recognize that capitalism has set us against each other. That it's not just something we can shrug off. These are real hurts. These are real pains that people have. And if we just say, well, that's not important, then that's not solidarity. Like a comrade is somebody you trust enough to bunk with. It's another soldier. And that's a bond that's, you know, having spoken to people who've been to war, that is a bond that is as close as a husband and wife. And if you need to be able to inspire that kind of trust in your comrades, and you're not going to be able to do that if you listen to their pain about being treated as less than because of their disability or their race or something like that, you're not going to be worthy of that trust. And that's not trivial. That's everything. That's the smallest, like history is fractal, society is fractal, our movement is fractal, and what we do interpersonally toward one another is going to be reflected in our revolution and the kind of world we build. And so this matters very much.
Well, MK Anderson, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Any positive vibes you want to throw out? I always like to end on a positive note, and how my listeners can follow your work.
Sure. I can come off a little bit spiky online, but I'm doing this because I love people and I want a better world. And I really hope we can do this work and be kind to each other and heal a lot of wounds and have a better world. You can sign up for my newsletter at mk-anderson.com, and there's a sign up link there. Whenever I have a new article, I release a newsletter. I need to do that for this one and for this podcast. You can follow me at Qualia, Qualia Redux, REDUX, all one word, no space, no underline or anything, on twitter.com. And keep an eye out, because I'm going to keep writing and I'm going to appear on podcasts whenever I can. Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with MK Anderson, writer and contributor at Protean Magazine. Be sure to check out more of her work at mk-anderson.com or on Twitter at Qualia Redux. That's Qualia Redux. REDUX. And of course, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews, where you can hear past archived editions of the Parallax Views main program, as well as the Parallax Views current events and ranting edition of the show, Parallax Views The Week That Was, with my co-host Casey. Lots of other different bonus content there, including video interviews as well. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.